living in the past. It's about savoring precious memories. Join us every Tuesday afternoon at 3 for Reminiscing on Sun Sounds.
Now, a limerick on Sun Sounds of Arizona.
There was a young lady named Shanker, who dozed while a ship lay at anchor. She awoke in dismay when she heard the mate say, "Let's hoist up the top sheet and spank her."
This is Sun Sounds of Arizona in Tucson, reading to make a difference for you. Stay tuned as we turn the page.
Some lovely music to help start your Friday morning here at 8 o'clock, 8:01 now, on Sun Sounds of Arizona. We hope you're having a wonderful day so far. It's going to be hot, hot, hot this afternoon, going up to possibly 110. The paper says 108, but what's the difference? We're going to go to the opinion page now, and there's an editorial cartoon here, kind of poignant. Here's some immigrants on a ship in New York Harbor approaching the Statue of Liberty, and mom is thinking about her little daughter standing next to her and wondering, what do I tell her the Statue of Liberty means? That's by Stoller. What's his name? Jeff Stoller of McNeil Syndication, whatever. Okay. So we're going to turn to the first editorial. I'll take Soccer Lacks Resolve to Fight Homophobia and Racism. This is by Scott Martell of the Los Angeles Times. Let's see. Here's a reason not to root for Mexico in the World Cup soccer tournament. Fans of El Tri chanting anti-gay slurs at players on the field. FIFA, the troubled organization that oversees world soccer, opened an investigation into reports that Mexico fans chanted the insults Sunday as German goalkeeper Manuel Neuer got ready for a goal kick. Yet this isn't anything new, nor limited to Mexico fans. In fact, Los Angeles Galaxy fans chanted the slur during a May match at StubHub Center in Carson against FC Dallas on, wait for it, the club's Pride Night celebration for fans. Oh, jeez. But it has been a persistent problem FIFA has failed to properly encounter. As The Guardian reports, FIFA issued 51 disciplinary actions over homophobia during 2018 World Cup qualifiers. Of these, 11 were handed to the Mexican Federation, with Argentina, Brazil, Chile, El Salvador, Honduras, Panama, and Peru also receiving multiple fines. FIFA additionally cited Colombia, Costa Rica, Ecuador, Paraguay, Uruguay, Greece, Hungary, and Serbia once each for homophobic chants. Racist taunting is also a problem. In March, Russia fans directed monkey noises at black French players during an exhibition game between the two national teams in St. Petersburg. That cost the Russian Federation a $31,000 fine. Jeez. But fines have not deterred such behavior. And that points up one of the fundamental problems with soccer's attempts to control racism, homophobic slurs, and other unsavory aspects of fan behavior. FIFA doesn't have the will to take meaningful steps to address the problems. It's true that its options are limited. An international federation doesn't have much direct control over fans in disparate countries, but it does have some tools beyond the slap on the wrist fines. It can, and occasionally does, halt play when the crowd starts hurling bigoted epithets and taunts, which is what it should have done Sunday, as the fans did their "a puto," a puto chant, using a slur reference for a gay sex worker, as the goalie put the ball in play. Instead, FIFA announced Wednesday that it fined the Mexican Federation, wait for it, $10,000. The Mexican Federation will pay the small sum while the offending fans get a big giggle. FIFA claims it's serious about confronting racism and homophobia among fans, but its lack of action speaks loudly. Sending a bill for a few thousand dollars to organizations that handle millions hasn't been effective. FIFA managed to throttle back hooliganism, that is, rowdy fans traveling to matches to fight with fans of the opposing team, through direct responses, including pressuring national federations and teams to ban admission by known hooligans to stadiums, and at the national level, barring travel to foreign countries where matches and tournaments are being held. Similar steps could go a long way toward combating the insults. So could FIF halting or even postponing more matches because of fan behavior. That would be a big step, yes, but it's clear that forceful action is necessary if FIFA is to knock some of the racist and homophobic tarnish off its sport. But then FIFA granted this World Cup tournament to Russia, which has a horrendous record on gay rights. If it was sincere about combating anti-gay attitudes, there were plenty of other countries it could have picked. And I think disqualifying teams or suspending them would have a lot more impact.
Yeah, $10,000. Are you kidding me? They find a baseball player that much for sticking his finger up to their fans.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So,
yeah.
Good editorial.
Yeah, okay. Very good editorial.
Over to you, Barney.
I agree with it. Trump lost the battle on immigration, but will he win the war? This is from Fareed Zakariyyeh. Fareed, incidentally, is a, I don't know. I've heard a lot of him. He's a columnist in a lot of magazines. And if you want to, I'll read the article and then tell you. Democrats are exultant that Donald Trump had to reverse his policy of separating immigrant families at the border, and there is good reason to celebrate. The policy was mean-spirited and unnecessary, but I do wonder whether this episode will prove to be as damaging to the president as liberals think. With this tussle, Trump sent a clear reminder to his supporters of one simple thing, that he is willing to get tough on immigration. The president's cruelty made it easy to oppose his policy, but in their delight at the Trump administration's latest misstep, Democrats may be walking into a trap. The larger question is surely, should the country enforce its immigration laws? Or, if circumvented, should we just give up? According to a UN report last year, the U.S. became the world's leading destination for asylum seekers, with a 44% increase of Central Americans, who comprised almost half the total at about $140,000. David Frum suggests in The Atlantic that most of these people are probably coming to escape poverty, rather than violence, which has been declining, and that many hope bringing children will help them avoid punishment. That's why, when asked in 2014 about the tens of thousands of unaccompanied children who had come to the border, Hillary Clinton responded, "We have to send a clear message. Just because your child gets across the border, that doesn't mean the child gets to stay. We don't want to send a message that's contrary to our laws or will encourage more children to make that dangerous journey." Immigration has become an issue that motivates a large group of Americans passionately, perhaps like no other. Some of this might be rooted in racism, but it also represents a kind of heightened nationalism. In an era of rampant globalization, people want to believe that they still maintain some sense of stability and control. Nationalism has been around for centuries, but it is now, in a sense, the last doctrine standing. The great story of the 20th century was the loss of faith. Between the ascendance of science, socialism, and secularism, people lost their trust in the dogmas and duties of religion, but this didn't change the reality that they wanted something they could believe in, something with which they could have a deep emotional bond. Nationalism has increasingly become that substitute for many on the right. being endowed with a strong and almost mystical attachment. For many on the left, by contrast, nationalism is more of an irrational affinity for a group of people with whom one shares an arbitrary border. Why should, say, a devout Catholic in New Hampshire feel a closer connection to a radical atheist who lives 2,500 miles away in California, compared to a fellow Catholic a few hundred miles away in Canada? But such has been the power of nationalism that it continues to move people to great acts of courage, loyalty, cruelty, and hatred. Immigration has become a litmus test for nationalism, perhaps because other sources have faded or become politically unmentionable. There was a time when nationalism was deeply intertwined in many corners of the globe with religion or ethnicity, and it would be described in those terms openly and proudly. But as Western societies became more diverse, and as minority groups within them asserted their own identities, it became more difficult to define nationalism by those older ingredients. So what remains? How does one define a nation? For Americans, political ideas and ideology have always been at heart. That is why being a communist could be thought of as un-American, but beyond ideology, there has also been, even in America, a more emotional conception of the nation. And immigration has become a proxy for that gut feeling, the sense that the country must be able to define itself, choose whom it will allow to come in and privilege its citizens over foreigners. The solutions to America's broken immigration system are complicated, but Democrats would do well to remember plain symbolism as well, something Bill Clinton and Barack Obama never forgot, which is why their rhetoric and actions on immigration were often far more centrist than those of many current Democratic leaders. In politics, people recall a few simple things. To illustrate that point, a pollster in the 1980s once told me a story. A focus group asked a man whom he would vote for, Ronald Reagan or his Democratic opponent, Walter Mondale. "Reagan," the man said, "Mondale is a communist." The pollster explained that this wasn't true. The man explained, "Well, maybe. I'll still vote for Reagan. One thing I know, no one's ever thought he was a communist. Trump might have lost this round, but no one will ever think he's soft on illegal immigration."
Okay, let's see here. Our third and final opinion is by Craig J. Cantoni. Craig J. Cantoni is a former business consultant, author, columnist, and community activist. Let's see, he is writing, "To halt mismanagement by the city and the county, start with barricades." Those are the traffic barricades. This is special to the Arizona Daily Star. "After living in Metro Phoenix for 30 years, my wife and I moved to Tucson in January. Tucson is much better than Phoenix. People are nicer, kinder, friendlier, more laid back, and not as materialistic. Also, the setting is prettier, the climate is nicer, and there is less congestion. At the same time, paradoxically, Tucson and Pima County are mismanaged and poor relative to Phoenix and Maricopa County. This raises a question. Is the Tucson area poor because it's mismanaged, or is it mismanaged because it doesn't have enough money for good management? Either way, the area is going to stay poor in the absence of better management, for wealthy corporations don't want to relocate their headquarters to a badly run metropolis. There is no need to rub asphalt in the wound by talking about the terrible condition of roads and the lousy traffic control. Tucson drivers are well aware of the decades of neglect and mismanagement of this core responsibility of government. Other examples abound anyway. Take traffic barricades. Yes, traffic barricades. That would be the orange and white objects that look like sawhorses with blinking orange lights. They are put out by both Tucson and Pima County and then abandoned, resulting in them being blown over in the wind, ending up in bike lanes or in the brush on the roadside. For instance, Tucson put barricades out when it sprayed de-icer on bridges this winter. Months after the chance of a freeze became nil, they were still not picked up. In Pima County, barricades are put up next to road hazards, but instead of fixing the hazards, the county leaves the barricades in place for months or even years. On a related note, the county picks up roadside litter less frequently than Halley's Comet comes around. Consequently, another guy and I picked up litter on a two-mile stretch of Craycroft and Kolb roads near our homes in Ventana Canyon. Are abandoned barricades a big deal? Yes, as they are visible symbols of mismanagement and lousy leadership. Or maybe the problem is corruption. Maybe a city council member or city supervisor is in the barricade business. Another symbolic example is the loop bike walk path. In a case of reverse alchemy, local government turns this golden attraction into a garbage dump by letting trash and litter of every description accumulate along the path, especially in the Rieto River bottom. And this is not something that citizens can clean up on their own, as so much flotsam and jetsam has accumulated in parts of the river bottom that a convoy of dump trucks would be needed to haul it away. Contrast this with the bike walk path along the Indian Bend in Scottsdale and along the Salt River in Tempe. These other paths are pristine by comparison. Finally, shame on the local real estate industry, an industry with abysmal civic-mindedness, as evidenced by the large number of 12 by 24 inch for sale signs planted in medians and roadsides and never picked up. What's the point of having sign ordinances if this is allowed? And why doesn't the city or county find the culprits or at least remove the signs? Is it because of the political power of the industry? On second thought, the city and county shouldn't do anything about these issues. They should continue with their mismanagement so that Metro Tucson doesn't become as prosperous and populated as Metro Phoenix. Okay, so he thinks we're slobs, but we're nicer than Phoenix. Okay. Let's turn to the letters to the editor, and you can take the first one.
Okay. Remember Reagan's view on immigration. Reagan said his Immigration Reform and Control Act, enacted November 6, 1986, would make any immigrant who'd enter the country before 1982 eligible for amnesty, a word not usually associated with the father of modern conservatism. This from the champion of the conservative agenda in 1984. I believe in the idea of amnesty for those who have put down roots and lived here, even though some time back they may have entered illegally. That's a quote. Reagan was a Californian. You couldn't live in California without encountering over and over good, hardworking, decent people. Recent arrivals from Mexico, some of whom worked for Reagan on his ranch. In January 1980, Reagan and I spoke for several hours. Speaking of the plight of immigrants was the only time he teared up. The man was a gentleman who, despite some controversial actions, actually cared about the less fortunate. I doubt any of his worshippers have ever read it. And that's signed by Sheldon Metz, who lives on the northeast side.
And for Trump, immigration policy is about image. What moves Bible-loving President Trump is not the un-American inhumanity and immorality of the enforcement of his policy on immigration. According to reports, the president told the GOP, the images of detained children and infants are bad for us. If that doesn't say it all, nothing does, says John Seba of the Northwest Side. Oh, you want me to keep going? Okay. That means you're going to have to take the first national and world story afterward. Oh, yeah, you'll have to be ready to jump to the next section.
Is Tucson a community? Recently, we're told that because some of the city golf courses are not making it a profit, they are under the threat of getting closed. Now we are being told that Pima County Community College is going to make major cutbacks in athletics, including the football program, for essentially the same reason, lack of money. Everything that makes a community doesn't have to make a profit. What's next? Close our parks and sell off the public benches? shut down our sidewalks to make room for billboards. Paraphrasing Glenn Parker's comment to the PCC board, it's not the cost of having these non-essentials, it's the cost of not having them. A real community needs non-essentials and finds ways to fund them or risks becoming just a dusty, wide spot on the highway through the desert on your way to someplace better. Are we a community or not? That from Jeffrey Miller, Northeast Side.
Okay, now the lies and the whys. On June 15th, the president participated in an impromptu news event in which he spouted 19 lies. He lies because he knows it works with his blind faith followers. These folks do not bother to validate his veracity, as they either accept his lies as facts or do not care about the truth. Every challenge to his lies is declared as fake news, a term used by his buddy Vlad. That would be a reference to Vladimir Putin. Truth is then deemed as a lie, while his lies are repeated by him and others until his followers believe them to be true. Factual articles published in this paper, which are clearly unbiased, but report any lies or other shortcomings, are enough for his followers to accuse this paper as having a bias against Trump. Perhaps the man actually believes he's telling the truth. It's very scary to have such a prolific liar in the presidency. A true claim he could make is that he is the greatest liar in POTUS history. And that's the opinion of Jeff Rayner of Saddlebrook.
Wanted more Democrats. This week, the unthinkable happened. The president actually made a sensible proposal. Lamenting the plight of split-up immigrant families, he called on Democrats to do something about it. There's just one problem. Currently, Democratic legislators number in the minority. To heed the president's advice, they must boost their numbers come November. I urge all voters to send as many Democrats to Congress as possible so they can immediately work on a bill to permanently stop the separation of immigrant families. If they can't get the president to sign that bill, we voters have but one remedy remaining: permanently separating the president from the White House and electing a Democrat to replace him. Thank you, Cindy Cohn of the Southeast Side.
And we have a duty to help asylum seekers. I am absolutely horrified by the way this county is treating innocent children whose parents were simply seeking asylum, and now they're being treated just as badly as they were in their home country. This is an absolute disgrace, and I am disgusted by America. When we elect people to office, we expect them to stand up for what's right morally, constitutionally, and ethically. As a first world nation, it's our duty to help those in need because we have the ability to do so. These are people who are innocent and seeking asylum, not illegally crossing the border. Innocent and seeking asylum, not illegally crossing the border. Okay. I am demanding that my elected officials stand up and do something. That's from Kayla Levine of the South Side.
In our final letter to the editor, where are Tucson demonstration photos? Centered among the letters to the editor in the June 19th Star is a photograph of protesters in McAllen, Texas, opposing the Trump administration's border policy of separating parents and children. On June 18th, the Star carried a picture of children demonstrating on the same issue in Miramar, Florida. On June 16th, the Star printed a picture of a protester in Scranton, Pennsylvania, also in opposition to zero tolerance. On June 15th, featured on the front page of the Nation and World section was a photograph again of protesters opposing separation of parents and children, this time in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Tucson has had two large protests in opposition to separating parents and children, June 1 and 14, in front of the DeConcini Federal Courthouse on Congress Street. I don't recall seeing any photograph in the Star of those demonstrations. Did I miss something? Couldn't the Star have replaced at least one of those out-of-state protest photos with a Tucson protest picture? And that from Louis Mastrangelo, Northwest Side. Thank you, Louis. Lois Mastrangelo, Northwest Side. On to you.
Okay, it's 8:24 on Sun Sounds of Arizona. You're reading the Arizona Daily Star. You're not reading the Arizona Daily Star. We're reading the Arizona Daily Star so that you don't have to. Let's see here, and we're turning to world and national news. I have jumped ahead here, and I'm ready with the first story. You didn't know I counted the letters to see who's got to get the first, and then I catch you unprepared sometimes. Okay, so yeah, I count them. I say, oh, I've got to jump to the nation and world. Okay, so what do we got here? Trump. Ah, here's one. It's Mrs. Trump. Okay. First Lady visits migrant children separated from parents in Texas. This is by Darlene Superville of the Associated Press, McAllen, Texas. Melania Trump visited migrant children Thursday during a brief stop at a Texas facility housing some of the youth separated from their parents as her husband's administration prosecutes adults who entered the U.S. illegally from Mexico. The First Lady, who has a 12-year-old son, smiled and laughed with the immigrant children. "Be kind and nice to each other, okay?" she said as she left one classroom at Upbring New Hope Children's Center and headed for another. Plans for her to visit a second facility where children housed in cages were seen by the Associated Press last week were canceled because of flooding there. The First Lady's stop in McAllen came one day after President Trump ordered a halt, at least for now, to the separation of immigrant families who are detained at the border. Her visit to the one-story red brick building was quickly arranged after Mrs. Trump decided earlier this week that she wanted to go, her spokeswoman said, adding that she wanted to lend support to the children who had been separated from their parents. The facility housed 55 boys and girls aged 12 to 17 on Thursday, but only about 6 of them had been separated from parents, officials said. The other children were placed there after they crossed into the U.S. alone. "I'm here to learn about your facility," the First Lady said, as she met with staff and Federal Health and Border Patrol officials. She asked how she could help these children reunite with their families as quickly as possible and how often they communicate with their families. She learned the children are allowed a 10-minute phone call twice a week. Mrs. Trump visited 3 classrooms, each time asking the children where they came from, their ages, and how long they had been at the center, and their favorite subjects. Staff said the children, who mostly are from Guatemala, typically spend between 42 and 45 days at the facility, which is operated by a Lutheran social services organization contracted by the government. "The children are often distraught when they arrive," staff said, but they reassured Mrs. Trump the youth are quickly assessed for any physical or mental health issues and are well cared for. The children attend school 5 days a week and have access to a variety of activities. Mrs. Trump left Washington wearing a green hooded military jacket that had "I really don't care, do you?" written in graffiti style on the back in white lettering that left the blogosphere wondering what message she was trying to send as she flew off to visit migrant children. I saw that picture. "I really don't care, do you?" Yeah, well, what? On a trip where she says she cares. Anyway, asked about the message, spokeswoman Stephanie Grisham said by email that it was just a jacket. "There was no hidden message. After today's important visit to Texas, I hope the media isn't going to choose to focus on her wardrobe." Grisham underscored that message with a tweet and the hashtag she cares and hashtag it's just a jacket. What? Let's see. Mrs. Trump had changed into a pale yellow jacket before arriving in McAllen and wore that during the more than hour-long visit to the center, but donned the green jacket once again as she returned to the White House. She went straight to the Oval Office to brief the president, who later tweeted that the jacket's message referred to her feelings about the fake news media. Okay. As a former fashion model, you would think she would pick her fashion more carefully. I don't know. Over to you, Barney.
Courting Putin, Trump Jolts Strongest U.S. Allies, by Matthew Lee and Josh Lederman of the AP. Washington, as Donald Trump presses ahead with plans for a summer summit with Russia's Vladimir Putin, the U.S. president is jolting relationships with some of America's longest and strongest allies. Amid concerns over Trump's apparent desire to be cozy with the Russian leader, he is pursuing increasingly nationalistic foreign and trade policies and delivering scathing personal attacks on traditionally friendly leaders who don't share his views. The White House announced Thursday that that National Security Advisor John Bolton would travel to Moscow next week after stops in London and Rome to discuss the potential Trump-Putin meeting expected to be held in the Austrian capital of Vienna in the days following NATO's July 11-12 leaders' summit in Brussels. Administration officials say a White House advance team has traveled to Vienna to scout locations and make other logistical preparations for a summit should it come off. Bolton's stops in Britain and Italy may be designed to assuage new nervous Europeans about Trump's intentions for the Putin meeting, which would come just a week after Trump stunned European allies by suggesting that Russia should be readmitted to the Group of Seven Club of Industrialized Economies without forsaking its annexation of Crimea, for which it was expelled in 2014. Yet Bolton's discussions in the European capitals are unlikely to smooth over what are becoming widening fractures in the transatlantic relationship that the president has seemed to welcome. To Trump, the tough approach to allies constitutes a long-needed reassertion of U.S. sovereignty following a worrying period of decline in which Washington was too deferential, too politically correct on the world stage, and too trusting of global institutions to look out for America's best interests. Those who complain that the status quo is being upended, Trump argues, are correct and missing the point. And the list of spurned parties is quickly growing. Trump's pursuit of his America First agenda has put the U.S. at odds with the rest of the G7 democracies, sowed major divisions with Europe and Canada, and risks altering the balance of power in the Asia-Pacific. Nowhere, though, have the tensions crystallized more than in Europe, where concerns about Moscow are visceral and closer to home. In recent weeks, Trump has attacked Germany's chancellor, ignoring her and the leaders of Britain and France, embraced Italy's new populist prime minister, and congratulated Hungary's authoritarian premier. The result has alarmed many who view the transatlantic partnership to be a bedrock of post-World War II international stability and security, but it has also left America isolated as administration promises that America First does not mean America alone appear to fall by the wayside. The era of American complacency in the international marketplace is over, Trump's trade advisor Peter Navarro wrote this month in an op-ed to the New York Times. Trump has also managed to rattle usually inflammable Canada by hurling personal insult at its Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. He has accused Trudeau of making false comments about trade and has slammed the Prime Minister for acting meek and fluid in his presence and then complaining about Trump and tariffs publicly. At the same time, Trump has fueled anger, resentment, and confusion in Europe with punitive trade tariffs, withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal, and the Paris Climate Accord, and pullouts from the two Europe-based UN agencies, including the Human Rights Council, just this week. The ties that bind us are under strain, NATO chief Jens Stoltenberg wrote in an opinion piece this week. Stoltenberg, who has had a relatively cordial personal relationship with Trump, was hopeful for the future that his warning was a clear sign of unease about the friction. Nowhere is it written in stone that the transatlantic bond will always thrive. That doesn't, however, mean that its breakdown is inevitable, Stoltenberg said. On to you, Bill.
Okay, and let's see. Obama, like Trump, grappled with migrant family detentions. This is by Amy Taxon of the Associated Press, Santa Ana, California. The Trump administration isn't the first to grapple with the question on how to handle tens of thousands of immigrant families arriving on the U.S.-Mexico border. 4 years ago, Barack Obama faced a similar crisis when record numbers of Central American immigrants fleeing violence began to show up at the border. Officials had to deal with the same sort of case the current administration began fighting Thursday, a day after President Trump issued a new executive order to stop separating migrant families. More than 60,000 family units, which the U.S. government defines as a parent and child, were stopped along the border in the 2014 fiscal year, a four-fold increase from a year earlier. In the last fiscal year, that number has exceeded 70,000. Initially, the Obama administration released mothers and children with notices to appear in immigration courts in cities where they were headed. At times, immigrants were transported from Texas to Border Patrol facilities in other states so that agents could keep up with ballooning arrivals. The Obama administration then moved to hold mothers with children in family detention facilities, a 100-bed center in Pennsylvania, and two larger facilities that opened in Texas in 2014. Those spaces provided a few thousand beds. Immigrant advocates opposed the move, arguing that minors couldn't be kept for long periods in these facilities because of a 1997 settlement agreement governing the treatment of immigrant children. A federal judge in Los Angeles agreed and ruled that the children could not be kept in detention. The administration then started releasing many families more quickly, since short detention stints would neither deter immigrants from coming nor give immigration courts enough time to evaluate asylum claims, said Seth Stotter, a former Assistant Secretary of Homeland Security for Border, Immigration, and Trade Policy in the Obama administration. The U.S. government could erect more detention facilities, Stotter said, but resolving asylum claims quickly isn't so easy, since immigration courts are backlogged with hundreds of thousands of cases, and immigrants often need time to obtain evidence from their countries. It is less about whether there is space to put people. They can find space to put people, but the real issue is legal, he said, adding that ankle bracelets or monitoring programs might help ensure immigrants to show up for court without the need for continued detention. The Trump administration has sought to deter immigration through a zero-tolerance policy announced in April that mandated the criminal prosecution of all immigrants caught at the border. Authorities began jailing the parents and sending their children to government-contracted shelters, sparking an outcry from immigrant advocates and many lawmakers. After separating more than 2,300 children from their parents, the administration shifted course this week and said families would be detained together. Another challenge the administration faces stems from claims by many of these immigrants that they are fleeing violence and persecution in their countries. Barney?
GOP-led House narrowly passes farm bill. Dispute with Senate is expected, by Juliet Linderman and Kevin Freaking of the AP. Dateline Washington, the Republican-led House narrowly passed a sweeping farm bill Thursday that would toughen work requirements for food stamp recipients. The bill passed by a vote of 213 to 211. Democrats unanimously opposed the measure, saying it would toss too many people off government food assistance. But 20 Republicans also voted no, giving GOP leaders a brief scare in what was their second attempt to pass the farm bill. In May, they suffered an embarrassing setback when 30 GOP members opposed passage in an effort to force a vote on conservative immigration legislation. The measure also renews the safety net for farmers at a time when President Trump's tough talk on tariffs threatens to close off foreign markets for many of their products. The House bill sets up a certain clash with the Senate, which is looking to make mostly modest adjustments to existing agricultural programs without picking a fight over food stamps. Representative Mike Conaway, the Republican chairman of the House Agricultural Committee, said he believed there were concerns among some GOP lawmakers about the amount of spending in the bill, as well as changes to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Plan, or SNAP. "I knew it was going to be razor thin," Conaway said of the vote. "The bill requires able-bodied adults aged 18 to 59 to work or participate in job training for 20 hours a week in order to receive food stamp benefits that average about $450 a month for a family of four. Government auditors estimate that in 10 years, the SNAP caseload would shrink by about 1.2 million people in an average month if the bill becomes law." House Speaker Paul Ryan, Wisconsin, said the changes will close the skills gap, better equip our workforce, and encourage people to move from welfare to work, so more Americans have the opportunity to tap into the economic prosperity we're seeing right now. The legislation has traditionally been bipartisan, blending support from urban Democrats supporting nutrition programs with farm state lawmakers supporting crop insurance, farm credit, and land conservation. The Senate earlier this month unveiled a budget-neutral and bipartisan bill. A Senate committee approved the legislation last week, 20-1. Although the House bill broke from that bipartisan convention, its position on work requirements for SNAP recipients is consistent with the Trump administration's priorities. Earlier this year, Trump signed an executive order directing federal agencies to enforce existing work requirements and review all programs, waivers, and exemptions. The measure also limits circumstances under which families who qualify for other poverty programs can automatically be eligible for SNAP and earmarks $1 billion to expand work training programs. Democrats have expressed outrage over the bill, with Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi calling it cruel and destructive. Representative Colin Peterson of Minnesota, the ranking Democratic lawmaker on the House Ag Committee, said the bill simply doesn't do enough for people it's supposed to serve. It still leaves farmers and ranchers vulnerable. It worsens hunger and it fails rural communities, Peterson said. Zippy Duval, president of the American Farm Bureau Federation, called passage of the House bill a big win for farmers.
Okay.
How do you, Bill?
Time for one more story before we turn it over to sports here. And let's see what to read. Charles Krauthammer, conservative voice. He's frequently an editorial writer here in the Daily Star. Charles Krauthammer, conservative voice, dies at 68. This is by Hillel Attali, AP national writer, Dateline New York. Charles Krauthammer, the Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist and pundit who helped shape and occasionally dissented from the conservative movement as he evolved from Great Society Democrat to Iraq War cheerleader to denouncer of Donald Trump, died Thursday at age 68. His death was announced by his longtime employers, The Washington Post and Fox News. Krauthammer had announced a year ago he was being treated for a cancerous tumor in his abdomen, and earlier this month revealed that he likely had just weeks to live. "I leave this life with no regrets," Krauthammer wrote in the Post, where his column has run since 1984. "It was a wonderful life, full and complete, with great loves and great endeavors that make it worth living. I am sad to leave, but I leave with the knowledge that I lived the life that I intended." Sometimes scornful, sometimes reflective, he was awarded a Pulitzer in 1987 for his witty and insightful commentary and was an influential voice among Republicans, whether through his syndicated column or his appearances on Fox News Channel. Krauthammer is credited with coining the term the Reagan Doctrine for President Reagan's policy of aiding anti-communist movements worldwide. He was a leading advocate for the Iraq War and a prominent critic of President Barack Obama, whom he praised for his first-class intellect, first-class temperament, and denounced for having a highly suspect character. Krauthammer was a former Harvard medical student who graduated even after he was paralyzed from the neck down because of a diving board accident, continuing his studies from his hospital bed. He was a Democrat in his youth, and his political engagement dated to 1976 when he handed out leaflets for Henry Jackson's unsuccessful presidential campaign. But through the 1980s and beyond, Krauthammer followed a journey akin to such neoconservative predecessors as Irving Kristol and Norman Podhoretz, turning against his old party on foreign and domestic issues. He aligned with Republicans on everything from the confrontation with the Soviet Union to rejection of the Great Society programs enacted during the 1960s. And with that, the time is now 8:45, and we get to turn to sports, and the big story today we'll find out in just a second. We'll find out what recent Arizona Wildcats are up to do today, unless you want to do something else, but I'll leave that up to you. Barney?
Favorite son! Well, Phoenix stabs former Arizona Wildcat DeAndre Ayton with the number one overall pick in the NBA draft. And if you follow basketball, that ain't no surprise. Okay, New York. Bruce Pascoe says, for the last few weeks, months, into some analyst years, DeAndre Ayton was destined to be number one. A super skill, 7 foot one Bahamian who simply could not be passed over. A double-double machine in his one season with the Arizona Wildcats, opposing zone and junk defenses be damned. His selection Thursday as the number one pick by the Phoenix Suns on a night when fellow ex-Wildcats Raleigh Atkins and Alonzo Trier went undrafted appeared to be one of the more undramatic number one picks in the NBA history. Except when it really came down to a Thursday in the final seconds, the otherwise supremely confident Ayton still had to look around for some confirmation from his mom. When I saw the commissioner come to the podium, I was nervous. My hands were sweaty, Ayton said. I kept asking my mom, do you think I'm going to be number one? Do you think I'm going number one? Yes, of course he did. The Suns made the long-expected pick, passing up hometown product Marvin Bagley, the third, second to Sacramento, and Slovenian guard Luka Doncic, third to Dallas via Atlanta, keeping the Bahamian big man in his adopted home state. That was what Andrea Ayton pretty much figured. When the countdown started, he was like, Mommy, how do you feel? Andrea Ayton said. I said, I feel good, and I said, I have faith. You know, sometimes we have the answer, but we are still nervous about it. That's like a thing, but I have faith. I was calm, comfortable. I knew he was going to go number one. She just didn't tell Andre that. I just tell him, I have faith, she said. That's all I said. Of course, she was right. Everybody was right. And it didn't take long before the Suns actually did it and the reality set in. Having my name called to be the first pick for the Phoenix Sun was mind-blowing, Ayton said. Having all that confidence and leading up to that point when I saw NBA Commissioner Adam Silver come out, I was just waiting for my name, and when he called it, my mind went blank. I just did the routine everyone else was supposed to do, and I just got up and enjoyed the moment, and I saw the reaction on my mom's face. It was just priceless. It was a celebratory moment for Ayton, his native Bahamas, the Suns, and the Arizona Wildcats alike. The Bahamas had not produced a number one NBA pick since 1978, when Mitchell Thompson was picked first by Portland. No Arizona player had ever gone number one, though past Wildcat stars Derek Williams and Mike Bibby got as close as number two. The Wildcats now have 10 NBA draft picks, under Coach Sean Miller, who took over the Wildcats in 2009 and 10. I'm thrilled for his family, said Miller, who sat with the Aitons at their table inside the green room. I'm really excited for him. We all know he's incredibly talented, but also smart and a great teammate. And this article is very long, and you got the gist of it, so we won't take up the whole 15 minutes of sports with this article. On to you, Bill.
Fair enough, yeah. another one of our famous freshman one-and-done players, which I don't think really do all that much good. I'd like to get a team that sticks together a couple of years one of these days. I don't know.
You're right.
Yeah.
Look at Villanova.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the last time we won, it was like Sean Elliott and those guys, and or it was the following team, Matt Othick and company. They stuck together for 3 or 4 years. Anyway, I'm torn between Major League Baseball and the World Cup, but since the Cubs lost, I'll go with the World Cup. Oh, boy. I'm going to apologize in advance when I mess up all these names. Okay, Neymar, Salah, Messi are being stifled early in the World Cup pool play. This is by Mauricio Savarisi, the Associated Press, Saransk, Russia. With nagging injuries, heavy marking from opponents, and some simply uninspired play, the top stars of the 2018 World Cup have struggled to deliver on the impossible expectations they carried into the tournament, with one prominent Portuguese exception. Aside from Cristiano Ronaldo, who has all four of Portugal's goals in two games, many of the biggest names are off to a shaky start. No one has had rougher treatment from the opposition than the world's priciest player, Neymar. During Brazil's opening 1-1 draw with Switzerland, the 26-year-old was fouled 10 times, the highest number on a single player in a single match since the 1998 World Cup, when England's Alan Shearer took 11 challenges against Tunisia. Overall, Switzerland fouled Brazil 19 times with little intervention from the referee, and it worked, especially on Neymar. Brazilians suggested their opponents were too violent. Swiss midfielder Gelson Fernandez, thinks Neymar has another problem. He just falls too much, Fernandez said. Fernandez said after the game in Rostov on Don. That's the name of the place where it was played, Rostov on Don. Out of these 10, only 7 or 8 were fouls, he said. We have to stop their star, and he is the star. Neymar felt the effects of the Swiss strategy long after Sunday's match ended, limping out of training Tuesday as he continues to recover from a foot injury he picked up before the tournament. He trained Wednesday and was confirmed as a starter for the match against Costa Rica on Friday. Superstar Lionel Messi faced heavy marking too, but he also had two uninspired performances for Argentina, which is now on the verge of early elimination after a 3-0 loss to Croatia on Thursday. Throughout the matches against Iceland and Croatia, disciplined defenders and midfielders stopped Messi from making his famous runs and getting one-on-one chances. Against Iceland, Messi saw his penalty spot kick saved by goalkeeper Hannes Halldorsen, and the game ended 1-1. Against Croatia, he crumbled with the rest of the team, which now desperately needs to beat Nigeria in the last round of the group stage to have a chance of advancing to the next phase. Messi is human, Aguero said after the Iceland match. Sometimes things happen for a reason. We need to be with him. This was a bad day, but he can decide a match at any given moment. Hope he is better against Croatia. And Croatia was taking note. You can't stop him with one player. You have to defend like a team. You saw that with Iceland, defender Dejan Lovren said ahead of the Argentina clash late Thursday. Egyptian striker Mohamed Salah set a Premier League scoring record for Liverpool and held all the hopes for a deep run by the Pharaohs in their return to the World Cup until he injured his shoulder playing for Liverpool in the Champions League final in a clash with Real Madrid's Sergio Ramos of Spain. Salah set out the opening 1-0 loss to Uruguay in Yekaterinburg with coach Hector Cooper, hoping to have him fit for Egypt's second match against Russia. He made his World Cup debut in St. Petersburg and scored from the penalty spot, but only after the hosts led by 3 goals and his mobility was clearly affected. He barely touched the ball in the first half and avoided physical contact with Russian defenders during the entire game, and Egypt was eliminated with one match left to play. Ronaldo isn't entirely alone in starting strong. Diego Costa has 3 of Spain's 4 goals. Harry Kane has both of England's, and Luke Modric scored 1 goal and set up the other in Croatia's 2-0 win over Nigeria. There's plenty of time for the others to turn things around. Kylian Mbappe, a 19-year-old striker at the center of the second most expensive transfer in history, managed just one chance in France's 2-1 win over Australia in Kazan, but scored Thursday against Peru in front of an empty net. It's early, and the tournament has seen plenty of stellar play from lesser-known players, but many of the star scorers have work to do. Okay. So, back to you, Barney.
Well, I was going to follow up on the draft picks, but I'm confused. So, I'm going to go with baseball because everybody's wondering what's going on there. The Yankees, 4 over the Mariners, 3. The Yankees are in first place. And where are the Mariners? They're up there. Yeah, they're in second place in the West with 46 wins. The Yankees have 50 wins already, and that's the most wins. There are 3 teams with 50 wins in the American League, Houston and Boston and New York. Okay, so the Yankees took the Mariners 4-3. Aaron Judge and Miguel Andujar hit 2-run homers for their 4 runs. And the Rockies, 6 over the Mets, 4. Nolan Arenado had a good game. He had a home run and a double to account for 5 of the Rockies' 6 runs. The Red Sox, who are up there in a battle with the Yankees for first place in the East, the Red Sox have played 4 more games than the Yankees. They've won as many and lost 4 more, so they'll catch up there somewhere. They beat the Twins 9-2. Rick Porcello allowed 1 hit in 7 innings, and Mookie Betts and Andrew Benintendi homered as Boston beat host Minnesota. Boston's got these great, they just drafted so well. They've got a bunch of really good young players on the team. And the Washington Nationals took the Orioles 4-2. Brewers 11, Cardinals 3. Let's see, the Brewers, they're pretty good, aren't they? Yeah, Milwaukee's in first place in the Central with 44 wins. The National League leading teams have 43 wins, the most. And in the American League, 2 teams have 50 wins. Now, I don't know what that tells you. Anyway, let's see. Reds, 6. Cubs, 2. Oh, that's the one you were complaining about. Okay. Jesse Winker. There are a lot of Cubs fans here, so we'll read this little article. Jesse Winker hit a go-ahead grand slam in the 6-run, 6th inning to push Cincinnati past Cubs. Past visiting Chicago, trailing 12-2, entering the bottom of the 6th, Cincinnati sent 11 men to the plate, with Winker delivering the big blow with his 4th home run of the season over the center field fence off Chicago reliever Randy Rosario's. I don't know, they say that baseball park that the Reds play in is like a matchbox. You hit the ball over the center field fence, it's no big deal. Anyway, and the D-backs. Oh, the D-backs. They beat the Pirates 9-3. Ketel Marte, he's a fun guy. And Alex Avila, watch. Does he ever hit? Yeah, he hit a home run yesterday. Each hit 2-run homers as Arizona scored 8 runs in the first 3 innings to power its way to victory over host Pittsburgh. Marte's blast capped a 3-run first, while Avila's shot in the 3rd extended Arizona advantage to a 2-0. And, you know, because, oh, there it is. Okay, what is? I was being critical of Alex Avila. What's he hitting now? 124. Well, he gets a hit almost once every 10 times up. Well, a little more than once every 10 times up. Oh, my gosh, it's time to quit, isn't it?
That's all the time we've got for sports, sadly.
Go!
And likewise, that's all the time we've got here in this hour. Time is 8:58, almost 8:59 here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. We're going to take a 2-minute break. I want you to stay tuned for an important message from Clean Elections. And we'll be back with, the death notices and Ask Amy and whatever else we can. So please stay tuned.
Sun Sounds is supported by Clean Elections,
Election day is coming. You can find out where your candidates stand on the issues by watching an upcoming debate. Visit azcleanelections.gov/debates for a schedule of debates and ways to watch.
SunSounds has expanded our coverage of the news in Southern Arizona with the Yuma Sun Daily, every Thursday morning at 9:30, right after the Arizona Daily Star. It's a new way for you to know more about another part of our state. It's the Yuma Sun Daily, every Thursday morning at 9:30 on SunSounds.
You can hear the news from Green Valley.